This week on Making Contact.
Thousands upon thousands and thousands have died needlessly and unnecessarily by state policy because of Jim Crow. This is genocide.
Inconsistency and contradiction are no stranger to American policy and politics. One of the true ironies of the American Civil Rights Movement is that while the U.S. was trying to lead the way in developing a framework for international human rights, it was leaving its own citizens behind, refusing to acknowledge the systematic social abandonment of African Americans. On this edition, we'll hear from Dr. Carol Anderson, author of Eyes Off the Prize, on this deep discrepancy at the heart of America's struggle for civil rights and human rights. I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Renowned author and activist, Dr. Carol Anderson is a visiting professor in the History Department at Harvard University. Currently on leave, she's working on her next book, Bourgeois Radicals, the NAACP, and the Struggle for Colonial Liberation. A recipient of many research fellowships from numerous foundations, Dr. Anderson holds a PhD from the University of Ohio and is a member of the U.S. State Department's Historical Advisory Committee. Her recent book, Eyes Off the Prize, The United Nations and the African American Struggle for Human Rights, was awarded both the Gustavus Myers and Myrna Bernath Book Awards. Recently, Dr. Anderson was a keynote speaker at the Human Rights at Home, Building Human Rights Movement Conference in San Francisco, California. This is an excerpt from that speech.
When the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, launched its legal assault on Jim Crow, you know, that is what everybody was watching. They were watching Gaines. They were watching the Murray decision. They were watching this, this triumphant path towards Brown and the overturning of Plessy. But at the same time, in the cauldron of the Second World War, the NAACP was also launching an equally and if not more important assault on the international level for human rights. And this assault was because as they looked at the condition of black America, because remember, we're coming out of the Great Depression. We're coming out of an unemployment rate of 50% to 80% in the black community. We're coming out of a condition where you had widespread, horrific lynchings. We're coming out of a condition where you have a Federal Housing Administration Act being put in place that systematically denies the right to access to housing to African Americans. So if you're black and you're trying to buy a house in a black neighborhood, you're not eligible. And if you're black and you're trying to buy a house in a white neighborhood, you're not eligible. So as they're looking at this, they're saying, this is not a civil rights issue. This is a human rights issue. And black America is in the midst of a human rights crisis, and a human rights crisis requires a human rights solution. And as it articulated these rights, and as it articulated its vision, it said human rights are absolutely essential because backed with the force of law and international sanction, it would break the back of slavery's legacy and Jim Crow's reality. An NAACP board member, William Hastie, who was the dean of Howard University's law school, as he looked at what the United States was trying to pull off in this post-war world, he was absolutely dismayed. He said, quote, "We cannot offer the blueprints and the skills to rebuild the bombed-out cities of other lands and stymie the rebuilding of our own cities. Slums have no place in America." And as he began to also go down the list in terms of education, housing, and employment, and he saw how far short the United States fell in terms of meeting the human rights needs of its citizens, he said he insisted that, quote, "the peacemakers must have more daring and vision than the war makers," unquote. I love that one. The association leadership, Walter White and W.E.B. Du Bois, could not have agreed more. And they were simply distressed by what they saw coming out of the Dumbarton Oaks Conference, which is where the Allies got together to try to do the first draft of what a UN would look like. And the Allies, Britain had its own thing going on. It really didn't want a strong international organization because, you know, it had empire to actually preserve. And it didn't want some international body coming in telling it how it was going to have to treat people in its own colonial regions, particularly when those folks were breaking free. And the Soviet Union, it had its own designs, and it didn't want to see human rights coming anywhere near. And then there was the United States of America that has billed itself as this arsenal of democracy, as this leader of the free world, and it had Jim Crow. And the organization that they had designed was designed to make sure that all of those inequalities never got touched. The NAACP and other NGOs saw this and said, not on my watch. We did not go through the hell of World War II in order to see a post-war world look just like the pre-war world. Well, for the U.S., as is, because what the U.S. was trying to do was this kind of juggling act. It was trying to continue to distinguish itself from the totally vilified and debased Aryan supremacy of the Nazis, right? While maintaining Jim Crow. Now, black folks had already figured it out. When you start reading through the black press at the time, in one thing, they went down and they compared the Nuremberg laws. And then they compared Mississippi's laws. One of these things is just like the other. So they knew what they were looking at. And it was really hard for the U.S. to do this kind of balancing act, but the U.S. was going to try. The NAACP and the American Jewish Congress got together and demanded of all things a human rights commission with enforcement powers. Now, the U.S. delegation looked at this and went, a human rights commission? To, like, enforce human rights? And the delegations, the consultants went, now, as I understand it, the reason why you asked us here was that because we have these huge organizations and we have influence. And you need to have that kind of influence sustained if you want to get this treaty through. Now, you don't want me to have to go back to my constituency of 500,000 dues-paying members. That's what the NAACP said. And say that you couldn't see your way clear in the midst of opening up Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Birkenau. You couldn't see your way clear to recognizing human rights and making sure that we don't have Nazi atrocities ever again. Now, you don't want me to have to go back and say that, do you? U.S. delegation went, oh, man, that would be a publicity problem, wouldn't it? So what the U.S. delegation did was John Foster Dulles, who had become Secretary of State under Eisenhower. He was a key member of this delegation, and he understood. He said, we've got to figure out a way how to pacify the consultants. Because you don't want these renegade organizations out there drumming up, they're getting their constituencies all mad, and then they're peppering, you know, Congress and the White House and newspapers talking about everything that we didn't do, that we should have done. But you also don't want to tick off the Southern Democrats. How do you square that circle? The way they squared that circle was to include upfront and personal in the UN Charter language that said there will be freedom from discrimination on account of race, language, sex, religion, and nationality. NAACP was like, oh, yeah, that's sweet. Then there was the language that said nothing in this charter gives the United Nations the right to intervene in matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of the state involved. That domestic jurisdiction clause was just like states' rights in terms of blocking penetration of rights into an abuser and a human rights violator. NAACP again sent up a well of protest, as did the other nations, particularly those who had been occupied by the Nazis. John Foster Dulles was clear. He said, quote, this is as far as we can go. If we do not get the domestic jurisdiction clause, the United States will have to rethink its involvement in this organization and all of its economic and social activities. Because this delegate, because, you know, the conference had gone hog wild in terms of adding these kinds of activities into this international body. Under that threat of the U.S. withdrawing once again from the international system, the delegations capitulated and allowed Article 2, Section 7 to become embedded in the U.N. Charter. So the U.S. could look like it still valued freedom and human rights, while making sure that it did not cross America's doorstep. There's several things that they did. One is that the subcommission dealing with the protection of minorities and the prevention of discrimination, and I think I just switched those two, which was something that the Soviets had pushed for very hard. It was really hard for the U.S. to say, oh, minorities don't need any protection, because the Nuremberg trials were going on at the same time. The U.S. started filleting the definition of exactly who and what was a minority. And as they filleted this definition of who's a minority, they concluded that African Americans were not a minority in the United States. They concluded that Native Americans were not a minority in the United States. They concluded that Mexican Americans were not a minority in the United States. They also concluded that Asian Americans were not a minority in the United States. In fact, they said, there are probably no minorities in the United States. I did not know that. They also took the lead because they said only those minorities, and they were talking about, they used the definition of national minorities. They said only those are the only ones that really cause problems in the international realm. They also took the lead in drafting the Covenant on Human Rights and the Declaration on Human Rights. Because they wanted to make sure, because they said the obstacles, and this is a quote, I love this, the obstacles to the United States support for a covenant was the non-discrimination article. So if you have the right to housing, the right to health care, the right to education, the right to employment opportunities, the right to life, right? The right not to be lynched. And then you've got this thou shalt not discriminate article sitting in there. That means that there's certain categories of those folks who are not minorities in your population. And you can't be doing this stuff too. And so they split, they figured out one of the ways that they could do this was to in fact split the Declaration of Human Rights when they were doing the covenant into two. And they put political and civil rights over here, saying those are the real rights. Those are the rights that emanate out of Western tradition and thought. And then there are those economic and social and cultural rights. Those were aspirations. Those were something that emanated out of the bowels and the bouillabaisse of Marxist thought. Those were not real rights. And they knew that there was no way that the Southern Democrats or the U.S. Congress would ever approve any kind of treaty emanating out of those Marxist thoughts. And so by being able to denigrate economic and social and cultural rights in a way that maligned them and marginalized them while elevating political and civil rights as the only real rights, it really began to constrict the platform for change and equality in the United States. They also championed a federal state clause that said that if the United States signed off on any of these human rights treaties, the federal government was signing off on it, but no state had to abide, even though the Constitution says a treaty is the law of the land. No state would have to abide by it. Well, the NAACP said, let's challenge this. And in 1947, following on the heels of a black communist group in 1946, the National Negro Congress, they petitioned the United Nations to investigate the human rights abuses in the United States. The petition, drafted by W.E.B. Du Bois, was brilliant, brilliant. But the NAACP made the fatal mistake of overestimating its allies and underestimating its opposition. But this petition said, and I love this, it said, there is a general agreement that the fundamental human rights, which members of the United Nations are pledged to promote without distinction to race, include education, employment, housing, and health. And it is clear that the Negro in the United States is the victim of wide deprivation of each of these rights, unquote. It has statistic and laws and data like nobody's business wrapped around elegant language in this petition that documented, for instance, that in school districts where African Americans comprise 75% of the school population, only $2.12 per capita was spent on their education, as opposed to $28.50 per white student. They documented that in 43 and 44, that in the southern states where most African Americans lived, over 111% more was spent on the education of white students than African American students. In Mississippi, it was 499%. And they did the same thing as they're rolling through the statistics on health care, housing, employment, and civil rights violations, including disfranchisement and lynching in the criminal justice system. And one diplomat said, oh, we've got to stop this because we're getting ready to be exposed as a nation of hypocrites.
We'll continue with Dr. Carol Anderson's speech in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. Dr. Carol Anderson was the keynote speaker at the Human Rights at Home Conference in San Francisco, California in January. The conference was organized by the Women's Foundation of California, who has generously donated to the National Radio Project. We continue now with her keynote address.
Eleanor Roosevelt was a key element in stopping the NAACP's petition from being heard by the Commission on Human Rights. And after that commission, that petition got scuttled, she then did what I call the education of Walter White, letting him know exactly where the NAACP had erred in exposing the United States to international ridicule for its treatment of its African-American population. In fact, in a heated exchange with W.E.B. Du Bois, Roosevelt had said, quote, as far as she was concerned, the colored people in the United States would be better served in the long run if the NAACP were not placed on the agenda of the U.N., unquote. After she had really berated Walter White for even going that far, taking that step, she then did the ultimate, and that is to resign from the board of directors of the NAACP. Walter White looked like a James Brown video begging her, please, Eleanor, don't go. Please don't go. You don't. Your name means so much to us. And think about that. You've got a powerful former first lady sitting on your board of directors in 1947. That's cachet. That's clout. That's prestige. That gets you into doors that you would never be able to get into before. And so the NAACP is now having to make some very conscious decisions about, does it push Eleanor Roosevelt so far that they alienate a powerful ally? Or do they back off of human rights as the agenda? They chose to back off. The African American left, meanwhile, continued to push. In fact, W.E.B. Du Bois' ouster from the NAACP was due in part to his intense desire to make sure that the NAACP maintained its human rights focus and that it did get its petition onto the U.N. In 1949, he, in fact, drafted a petition to the United Nations that dealt with the case of Rosa Lee Ingram. Rosa Lee Ingram was a poor, black, southern, sharecropping woman in Georgia with 12 children. Her neighbor, a white man, had wanted the land that she was on. She's thinking, I got 12 mouths to feed. I can't give up my land. And he started beating her so badly, as Du Bois said, that the blood ran. Two of her sons, a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, jumped in to save their mother. In the process, the man was killed. Rosa Lee Ingram and her sons, 14 and 16, were convicted of murder and sentenced to die in the electric chair. Du Bois said, not on my watch, and drafted a petition to the UN that was elegant, powerful, and beautiful. The State Department and the Justice Departments, I mean, reading their memos is chilling. They saw W.E.B. Du Bois' petition coming through for the committee to save Rosa Lee Ingram, and they said, oh, my God, this is going to be a problem because the woman's black, she's poor, she's a sharecropper, and she's in the South. Does this not expose all of the inherent inequalities in American society? And as they defined this petition as being Soviet-inspired and communist-inspired, they attacked the credibility of it. And it's like the shell game, that, you know, that OP, you know, find the thing, is where it takes folks' eyes off of the important part, that you have these structural inequalities that have resulted in a death sentence for a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old, and a woman who was being attacked. The sentence eventually got commuted to life, as if that was somehow more just. They really went after the Civil Rights Congress, who in 1951 broke all the rules and charged the United States with genocide. And what the Civil Rights Congress did, and this was a black communist organization, what they did is, because the Cold War is really hot and burning right now, they knew that if they just started pulling data together from their sources, how easy it would be to attack. So they used U.S. Census Bureau data. They used the data coming out of federal reports, such as the President's Commission on Civil Rights to Secure Justice, or We Secure Justice. I forget the name of the report right now. But it was a landmark report that had all of this data in there, and they were using NAACP records. They were using unimpeachable sources to document the life expectancy differential between African Americans and whites in American society, and then looking at the structural inequalities that had caused that difference in life expectancy, saying that, in fact, when you add this up over time, thousands upon thousands and thousands have died needlessly and unnecessarily by state policy because of Jim Crow. This is genocide. State Department went, oh, here we go again. I swear, why don't these folks just sit down and be grateful? And Eleanor Roosevelt said, and this I didn't put in the book, Eleanor Roosevelt said, well, it's not like we killed all of them. In fact, there are more of them now. So how could it be genocide? Well, one of the things is that William Patterson, who was the head of the Civil Rights Congress, responded. He said, genocide doesn't require you to wipe out every last living one of them. Drat nabbit. It only requires you to have the intent to destroy in whole or in part. And we have fully documented the in part. State Department said, oh, you got to go. One of the things that they did was they made sure that they defined the Civil Rights Congress as a pure communist organization, totally divorced. And they used the NAACP as the battering ram to beat up on the Civil Rights Congress. This is an old, tried and true strategy. Anybody studying colonialism knows it well. Divide and conquer. And they described the Civil Rights Congress as a communist organization, and that there was no basis in fact for this charge of genocide. Even with all of that, by the time the Eisenhower administration came to power, there was such rumblings about the threat that human rights posed to the American way of life, to democracy as we know it, that they decided, these forces came together to try to beat back these NGOs who were using a human rights platform to try to alter the inequalities in the United States. What they came up with was the Bricker Amendment. The Bricker Amendment, Bricker named after a Republican isolationist from Ohio. He was backed by the American Bar Association, the American Medical Association, who was afraid of socialized medicine. Is what they thought that these UN treaties would bring about because of the emphasis on health care, right to health care, backed by the Daughters of American Revolution, the Veterans of Foreign War, all of these patriotic organizations, and over 60 senators for a constitutional amendment to change the treaty-making process. Changing that treaty-making process meant that instead of just having two-thirds of the Senate ratify it, now a treaty to become law of the land would not only have to have that process, it would also have to have both houses of Congress pass it with enabling legislation. Anybody who's ever tried to get a bill through Congress knows how tough that is. And then, because that still wasn't enough for them, then all 48 state legislatures would have to sign off on an international treaty before it could become law of the land. Now think about the Mississippi State Legislature debating the Genocide Convention. Because one of the things that the Southern Democrats had made very clear, and this is one of the reasons why they were backing the Bricker Amendment in toto, was that the Genocide Convention, as they saw it, was a backdoor method to a federal anti-lynching bill. And they wanted that thing stopped. What Eisenhower did was he had his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, go to the Hill and abandon all human rights treaties. In an incredible performance, he said, "You're right. The UN, there have been these domestic forces who have tried to use international human rights treaties as a method to change the domestic contours of America, and we're not going to have it. So we are now backing off of the Genocide Convention. We're backing off of the convention, the Covenant on the Political and Civil Rights, the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights, the Covenant on the Political Rights of Women, and the Covenant on the Abolition of Slavery." Just threw them all into the pot. Bricker said, "That's sweet, but that only confirms what we already knew. So we're pushing ahead with the Bricker Amendment." When it came down to it, the vote coming down was 60-30 for the Bricker Amendment. And, you know, they're counting. They're like, oh, my God, the Bricker Amendment's going to go through. It's going to go through. And somebody said, wait a minute. Where's Kilgore? Where's Harley Kilgore, Democrat, West Virginia? Somebody said, go find Kilgore. You know, like Kilroy? Go find Kilgore. And they send the Senate aides out looking. They're looking. They're like, somebody go to the bar. Will somebody go across the street to the bar? There he was in the bar across the street, drunk. And they went, oh, man. One aide got under this arm. One aide got under this arm. They dragged him back across the street to the Senate chambers. As the door is opening up and they're finishing the roll call vote, they went, oh, I see our esteemed senator from West Virginia. How do you vote? And you heard in the background, nay. Oh, nay it is. The motion fails. Now, whether Kilgore was the one who was talking, nobody quite knows. But when you think about that the Bricker Amendment went down by one drunken vote, gives you some sense of the power of the antagonism to human rights that was happening in the United States. And this wasn't minor, because the Genocide Convention, in fact, was not ratified by the U.S. until 1988, and then with a lot of if-then-but clauses. And the Covenant on the Political and Civil Rights was not ratified until 1992, again, with a lot of if-then-but clauses, the reservations. So this massive retreat from human rights to a civil rights, a narrowed civil rights platform that cannot address the full issues that you're dealing with in your communities, in our communities, is linked back to this moment in time. Thank you.
Dr. Carol Anderson was the keynote speaker at the Human Rights at Home Conference in San Francisco, California, in January. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, Yasuo Nagata, and the Women's Foundation of California. For a CD copy of program number 0806, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, and Emily Polk, production fellow. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Community Radio has an immediate opening for a part-time temporary pledge drive premium assistant to solicit items that will be given away as thank you gifts during our spring membership drive. The position runs from March 2nd until April 14th. Hours will vary, but should average about 12 per week. The deadline to apply is this Friday, February 24th at 5 p.m. For information on how to apply, go to KBOO's website, www.kboo.fm, or drop by the station during business hours and ask for an application.